From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
We don't want the blood, any more blood, Haitian blood, on American hands, on the international community's hands.
As the UN Security Council goes into emergency session on the situation in Haiti, the Congressional Black Caucus calls on President Bush to preserve the democratically elected government of Jean-Bertrand Aristide. We'll talk to Congressmembers Maxine Waters and John Conyers. We'll also look at the U.S. history behind coups in Haiti with journalist and activist Alan Nairn. Then, as thousands of gay couples marry in the United States, it is not the first time. We'll talk with transgender couples who have been married for years. All
Women.
That and more coming
I,
up.
I, Cindy, take thee, Miriam.
To be my wedded spouse.
To be my wedded spouse.
Well,
stay with us. Welcome to Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. French officials have privately told President Jean-Bertrand Aristide they want him to resign and form a new coalition government to be formed. One French official told the Miami Herald he does not have our support. We will now move to support a government of national unity. France also called for an international security force to be deployed. The UN Security Council is set to hold an emergency meeting today to consider a request by Jamaica that a UN-led peacekeeping force be sent to Haiti. The Organization of American States also planned to discuss the crisis today. A leader of the opposition, Guy Philippe, warned residents of Haiti to stay indoors. He said, quote, "In a few days, Haiti will be free of Aristide." Meanwhile, Haiti's capital, Port-au-Prince, is preparing for an attack by the armed gangs who've taken control of much of the north. Backers of Aristide have set up barricades throughout the city. The U.S. has closed its embassy. Public transportation has stopped. Aristide's wife, Mildred, said Wednesday she'd sent her two young daughters out of the country to stay with her mother. She told CNN, quote, "The threat is real." In news from Britain, a former member of Tony Blair's cabinet, Claire Short, has accused British intelligence agents of spying on UN Secretary General Kofi Annan in the run-up to the Iraq War. She told the BBC she had read transcripts of private conversations of Annan. Last year, the Observer of London reported that the U.S. and Britain carried out a dirty tricks campaign by spying on officials from Angola, Cameroon, Chile, Bulgaria, Guinea, and Pakistan, all UN Security Council members, in the lead-up to the vote on the Iraq War. Yesterday, the source of the Observer article, government whistleblower Catherine Gunn, was cleared of violating the country's Official Secrets Act after the government presented no evidence against her. One of the Pentagon's most hawkish advisors, Richard Perle, has quietly resigned his post on the Defense Policy Board. He was a leading advocate for the invasion of Iraq and had spent 17 years on the board. He was seen by some as an election year liability to President Bush. Perle wrote in his resignation letter to Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld, quote, "We are now approaching a long presidential election campaign in the course of which issues on which I have strong views will be widely discussed and debated. I would not wish those views to be attributed to you or the president at any time, and especially not during a presidential campaign." Perle has called for the expansion of the so-called war on terror to target North Korea and Iran. He has said France should be treated as an enemy. He has called for the U.S. to pull out of the United Nations, and he's been a fierce critic of the CIA and the State Department. The president of Macedonia, Boris Tragovsky, was killed today when his plane crashed in southern Bosnia. Six other officials died with him. Bad weather was cited as a reason for the crash. He was elected in 1999. The crash came on the same day Macedonia had been scheduled to submit its application to join the European Union. Agence France-Presse is reporting that Israeli forces killed two Palestinians today during a demonstration against Israel's construction of a massive wall through the West Bank. The State Department has criticized an Israeli raid on areas in the West Bank town of Ramallah. Israeli seized $8 million in the raid, claiming the money was earmarked for terrorist activity. In Washington, House Speaker Dennis Hastert told President George W. Bush he would not submit legislation extending the deadline for an independent investigation into the September 11th attacks. Bush publicly has said he supports an extension. The commission has warned that without more time, the panel would have to cut short its investigation of intelligence breakdowns in the period preceding the attacks. Also yesterday, the commission said National Security Advisor Condoleezza Rice also had declined its request to testify at a public hearing next month. President Bush and Vice President Dick Cheney have refused to meet with the full panel, only its chair and vice chair. And former President Bill Clinton and former Vice President Al Gore have agreed to meet privately with all members of the commission. In Iraq, the BBC is reporting that 1.7 million Kurds have signed a petition demanding a referendum on the future of the Kurdish region in northern Iraq. Meanwhile, in the northern city of Mosul, the city's deputy police chief has been assassinated, and two U.S. soldiers died after their helicopter crashed west of Baghdad. There were conflicting reports as to the cause of the crash. In a setback to supporters of school vouchers to pay for religious school, the Supreme Court ruled yesterday that states can withhold public scholarships from students preparing for the ministry. According to the New York Times, the 7-2 decision was a, quote, decisive rejection of the proposition that a government that subsidizes a secular activity must necessarily, as a matter of the constitutional free exercise of religion, subsidize the comparable religious activity as well. Federal Reserve Chair Alan Greenspan yesterday urged Congress to scale back retirement and Social Security benefits for future retirees. Meanwhile, he supported making President Bush's 2001 tax cuts permanent. According to the New York Times, the U.S. military is facing the gravest accusations of sexual misconduct in years, with dozens of servicewomen in the Persian Gulf area and elsewhere saying they were sexually assaulted or raped by fellow troops. The Pentagon's reporting that it has now received 112 reports of sexual misconduct among soldiers stationed in Iraq, Kuwait, and Afghanistan. In addition, at the Shepherd Air Force Base in Texas, about two dozen women reported to a local rape crisis center in 2002. And in campaign news, the New York Times today endorsed John Kerry in New York's Democratic presidential primary scheduled for Tuesday. Democrats in 10 states vote on March 2nd in what is known as Super Tuesday.
Pede da vida, seja o navio que parte o fim.
Pede pulsar. A pele, ai, ai.
This is Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
And good day to all of our listeners and viewers around the country.
Juan, a terrible loss this past week in Los Angeles.
Yes, Frank Del Olmo, the associate editor of the Los Angeles Times and a columnist and a veteran newspaper reporter and activist, really, in the Latino community, died suddenly of a heart attack in the newsroom of the Los Angeles Times on Thursday. And he'd been with the Times for 33 years since graduating from college and was well-known and well-loved in the Latino community and among journalists across the country. They were he was the founder, one of the founders of the California Chicano News Media Association, a founding member of the National Association of Hispanic Journalists, and a longtime figure in the Los Angeles community. The funeral service this week drew just about the entire cross-section of leadership in Los Angeles, Cardinal Mahoney, Mayor Hahn, day actor Edward James Olmos, and many community leaders and journalists to mourn. He was just 55 years old, mourned the passing of a really terrific journalist. And his wife, Magdalena Del Olmos, herself a major figure, activist in the Chicano community there, in her memorial of her husband, mentioned to the L.A. Times executives who were there that they should really start thinking about a paper as great as the L.A. Times in an era like Southern California, really having a Latino editor or publisher sometime in the future, because many people wondered why Frank, after so many years and such a good journalist, never got promoted to a top position at the L.A. Times.
Mm. Well, our condolences to Frank's family, which is greater than his own family, but the whole community. As we move now to our top story, to the rapidly deteriorating situation in Haiti.
Today at the United Nations, the UN Security Council is holding an emergency session on the crisis in the embattled Caribbean nation. Meanwhile, in Washington, the House Intelligence Committee is holding a closed-door meeting with Roger Noriega, the Undersecretary of State for Western Hemisphere Affairs and former staff member of Jesse Helms, the North Carolina Republican, and other U.S. officials running Washington's Haiti policy. Late yesterday, France called on Haitian President Jean-Bertrand d'Aristide to resign and said a United Nations-backed security force should be deployed to Haiti to stabilize the country. French Foreign Minister Dominique de Villepin said Aristide's government has lost its legitimacy and should be replaced.
President Bush yesterday rejected President Aristide's appeal for immediate security assistance from the international community to head off bloody insurrection, saying the U.S. would, quote, encourage the international community to provide a security presence only after there was what Bush called a political settlement. That remark confused some observers, given that it is Aristide's opponents who have rejected Washington's so-called peace initiative. Aristide accepted the plan. At the White House yesterday, Bush also warned Haitians not to flee to the United States.
We will turn back any refugee that attempts to reach our shore. And that message needs to be very clear as well to the Haitian people. We will have a robust presence with an effective strategy. And so we strongly encourage the Haitian people to stay home as we work to reach a peaceful solution to this problem.
Bush's statements yesterday immediately drew fire from members of the Congressional Black Caucus. At a news conference yesterday, Congressmember Elijah Cummings and Congressmember Charles Rangel addressed reporters.
We could be on the brink of a major catastrophe any minute now.
We don't want the blood, any more blood, Haitian blood, on American hands, on the international community's hands.
Congressmembers Rangel and Cummings speaking at the news conference.
Shortly after Bush made his remarks, Black Caucus members rushed to the White House to express concern at what they say is Bush's refusal to preserve the democratically elected government in Haiti. They first met U.S. National Security Advisor Condoleezza Rice and ultimately demanded to meet with Bush. Secretary of State Colin Powell and White House Chief of Staff Andrew Card were there as well. This comes a day after Ira Kurzban, the lawyer for the Haitian government, said on this program that the U.S. is arming and training the paramilitaries currently fighting to topple Aristide's government.
We turn now to Congressmember Maxine Waters, who is on the line with us. Can you talk about your meetings yesterday?
Yes, of course we can. We met with President Bush after we initially had a meeting with Secretary Powell and Condoleezza Rice. And basically, the message was there's an impending bloodbath in Haiti that the thugs and the ex-military people who have come in out of exile are armed, and they have taken over Gonaïves, and they've taken over Cap-Haitien, and they have boldly said to the press they're going to move into the capital. One leader, so-called thug leader, said they were going to come and arrest the president. Others saying they're going to just take over Port-au-Prince. And we believe if they come in with their rifles, with their guns, that Lavalas and the poor people will try and defend the city and the capital. They'll have their machetes, and it's going to be a bloodbath. You know, I told the president yesterday that this was an emergency and something had to happen now. And I reminded him that those of us who had watched what had happened in Rwanda did not ever want to see again an opportunity to save lives and not really do something about it. It's really in our hands. The United States is guiding this policy, and they have decided to wait it out. They want Aristide to run. They want him to leave. He's accepted the peace plan. The opposition has thumbed his nose at the peace plan. They are closely aligned with Noriega in the State Department. They wish that Aristide would leave. If not, they're prepared to play this dangerous game of letting these thugs get to the president in an effort to get rid of the president. It's a game that could be stopped today if the president wants to do it.
And your reaction to President Bush's threat to Haitians that they will be turned back if any of them try to leave the island of Haiti, given how he's never made statements like that, for instance, about Cuban refugees who attempt to leave Cuba. Your reaction to that statement?
Well, I the statement is so harsh, it's so unseemly, that it's almost unthinkable that the president of the United States, at a time when Haitians may be fleeing this impending bloodbath, would say to him, "You stay there," knowing that he's not sending anything, any troops, any multinational force there to have secured the city, to have stabilized it, and to say, "Go back into the trap, the possible death trap." I don't know what to think about him. We tried to impress on him yesterday to please send some people in there to stabilize the place. I'm hopeful that he didn't really mean what he said, and I'm hopeful today we're going to hear some better news about sending some multinational force in, letting France send somebody in, maybe expanding the number of Marines that we have down there, and I'm just going to hold my breath for a few hours here to see if we can get some help. And if not, then I think what we're going to have to do is to challenge the president, not only on that policy, but what he said yesterday about the immigrants.
But France has just called on Aristide to resign.
That's part of the well-orchestrated game. What has happened is Noriega, who's leading the team, started over a year ago to lock in France and Canada, the OAS, the UN, everybody into a unit. One would not move without the other, and that they would both follow the same strategy. And this strategy that you see is, number one, taking the plan to Aristide, the opposition disagreeing to the plan, the pressure mounting, the rebels who are armed with M16s continuing to march toward the capital, then one by one having the people who are players in the multinational committee that's put together by Noriega start to ask him to step down.
And for those of our listeners who don't know Roger Noriega, could you tell us about his prior history?
Well, you know, all that we know about him is that he was the chief of staff to Jesse Hams, and they have a long history of undermining Haiti. These are the people who started the great disinformation campaign where they tried to paint him as a psychopath. And they had people believing that he was crazy. And then it all got debunked by pros who went in and examined everything that was being said and how it was being done. And it turned out to be a disinformation campaign that was put on by Noriega and the clique that was basically supporting a coup d'etat against Aristide. And some of the same people are involved now that were involved then.
What about the Intelligence Committee hearing today, a closed-door hearing with Roger Noriega?
Well, I mean, you know, all they're going to get is what Roger Noriega gives them. I mean, he comes up on the Hill. He was up on the Hill yesterday with the Florida delegation, and he weaves this tale. They don't. Many of them don't know any better. They don't pay any attention to Haiti. Haiti is not important to a lot of these members of Congress. For the ones that have been involved, they've only been involved to protect the business interests and the old CIA that's had their hands down in Haiti for years. So he comes up here, and he just tells them whatever he wants them to hear. And his game, his whole game, is to topple Aristide. And that's what he's out to do, and he's successful in having them buy whatever he tells them, and he's wrong.
Maxine Waters, Congress member from Los Angeles, speaking to us from Washington. This is Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute. This is Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman here with Juan Gonzalez.
Many of the men leading the armed insurrection in Haiti right now are well known to veteran Haiti observers and, for that matter, the U.S. intelligence agencies that work closely with the paramilitary death squads which terrorized Haiti in the early 1990s. People like Louis Jodel Chamblain, the former number two man in FRAP, Guy Philippe, a former police chief who was trained by U.S. Special Forces in Ecuador, and Jean Tatoune, another leader of FRAP.
In an hour-long interview with the Washington Post published today, Guy Philippe vowed a bloody assault on Port-au-Prince, quote, very soon if Aristide refuses to leave office. Philippe and Chamblain told the paper Aristide's departure and his replacement by an interim leader who would call new elections was the only possible peaceful solution to their three-week-old insurgency. Chamblain said, quote, Aristide has two choices, prison or execution by firing squad.
Preparations against a possible assault by the paramilitaries were evident throughout Port-au-Prince. Pro-Aristide militia groups stepped up their vigilance in the increasingly tense capital, setting up roadblocks and burning tires after dark at intersections throughout the city. Vehicles in the city are being stopped and searched.
Philippe said some of his forces are already in Port-au-Prince. Some, he said, undercover in the National Palace. He predicted they would use intelligence to identify and locate leaders of pro-Aristide groups, quote, neutralize them and take the city in 1 or 2 hours. He said his forces would kill Aristide if he resisted an attack, but that a trial would be preferable either in Haiti or in an international court. Philippe said he would welcome an international peacekeeping force, providing Aristide was gone.
For a closer look at what is happening right now on the ground in Haiti, we're going to look back at the involvement of the U.S. in the 1991-94 coup period.
We're joined now by Alan Nairn, who is an investigative journalist and activist in Haiti during the 1991-94 coup period. He won the George Polk Award for his stories that prove the direct links between U.S. intelligence agencies and Haitian paramilitary death squads. Among the stories he broke was that the man who launched FRAP, Emmanuel Toto Constant, was on the payroll of the Defense Intelligence Agency. Alan Nairn, welcome to Democracy Now! Let me start by asking, is it proper to say Constant launched FRAP, or did U.S. intelligence agencies?
Well, Constant did, with the support of the DIA and also the CIA.
Can you talk about that period? Can you talk about the relationship when President Clinton went on the national airwaves and announced that the U.S. military was going to move in to go after the murderers and the thugs and the rapists, those who were doing this on the ground in Haiti? What was their relationship with the U.S. government?
Well, many of them were on the payroll of the U.S. government. Historically, the U.S. had backed repressive forces in Haiti. For centuries, France plundered the wealth of Haiti. And after that, when there wasn't much left, even though there wasn't much left to plunder, the U.S. backed a series of repressive regimes. Under the Duvaliers, through Israel, the U.S. funded massive military and intelligence aid. And after Baby Doc Duvalier was brought down by a popular uprising, the U.S. continued to back the paramilitary forces. Starting around 1989, the U.S. Defense Intelligence Agency encouraged the formation of FRAP, essentially a terrorist group. Colonel Patrick Collins, who was the U.S. defense attaché in Haiti, began working with Constant. And Constant was later placed on the CIA payroll. He received cash payments from John Camborian, the CIA station chief. Also, one of the key leaders of the coup that ousted Aristide from his democratically elected presidency the first time around, Michel Francois, was also on the payroll, according to the CIA payroll, according to a U.S. State Department official I interviewed. So many of the officials whom Clinton was claiming to be fighting were actually his employees. And if at that time Clinton had simply cut them off, completely ended their support, the Haitian public itself most likely could have brought down the coup regime without a U.S. occupation. The price of that U.S. occupation was that before Aristide was brought back, he was essentially forced to agree to abandon the economic program of the popular movement, a program of redistributing wealth from the rich to the poor. Aristide was pressured by Clinton and his national security advisor, Anthony Lake, to sign on to a World Bank IMF program, which, in the words of one of the main authors of that program, would redistribute some wealth from the poor to the rich. Aristide agreed to that in part because he saw that while he was in exile in the United States, his people were being killed on the ground by FRAP and by the people of Francois and the coup regime. And when Aristide came back under those conditions in a U.S. helicopter, moving around, surrounded by U.S. Special Forces people, cut off to a great extent from the popular movement. It was really the beginning of the end of the popular movement in Haiti, and also, I think, the beginning of Aristide's own corruption, which helped to lead to this current crisis.
Alan, you mentioned John Cambori in the CIA, the former CIA station chief, but I recall being back in the early 90s in Haiti, covering the events there. And I'll never forget the day before the USS Harlan County, which President Clinton and the UN were sending in peacekeepers in fall of 93. And I happened to be with a Daily News reporter at a restaurant in Patientville with some of the top anti-Aristide elite there, including us, the number two person in the port, who assured me and our reporter and my photographer that the Harlan County was not going to land the next day, that everything had been arranged. And I told him, what do you mean? You know, President Clinton is sending them in. And as we were sitting there in the restaurant, in walks John Cambori and sits down at our table and begins to huddle with the number two man at the port and various other officials. And the next morning, sure enough, just as the business people had predicted, Vicky Huddleston, the chargé d'affaires, and a bunch of others are stopped and blocked at the gate by a FRAP crew. And there's John Cambori serenely watching the whole situation unfold. I bumped into him on a plane ride a few weeks later and said to him, weren't you worried about all those FRAP people? And he said, oh, no, they didn't mean any harm. They're harmless. So it was clear that he was well aware of everything that was going on in the attempt to push back to Harlan County that day.
Yeah, that seemed to have been a case of one hand not knowing what the other was doing, because here you had one U.S. Force being interfered with by the FRAP people who were being backed by another. But what the first Bush administration and then Clinton did in backing FRAP was they backed a terrorist organization, and they were never held to account for that. Constant Jodel Chamblain, who was involved in the major massacre in Raboteau, who was also implicated in the assassination of the Haitian justice minister, Guy Mallory, they were never brought to justice, and neither were Bush or Clinton for backing them. And because of this failure to enforce the murder laws, people who should be serving prison terms are now leading an insurrection.
In fact, Emmanuel Constant is right here in the United States. Can you explain what happened to him when he came here and why he's protected, as Bush is talking about a war on terror and on terrorists?
Well, FRAP was involved in hundreds, perhaps thousands of murders of civilians. At one point, they set fire to the Cité Soleil neighborhood of Port-au-Prince. It's an undisputed fact that they were launched by U.S. intelligence. Clinton's Secretary of State, Warren Christopher, confirmed that fact after the initial report came out. Constant, I had several interviews with Constant and also with Colonel Collins, and the U.S. Obviously doesn't want that fact and that relationship going into. After the U.S. military came in and occupied Haiti, they seized the files, the archives of FRAP and the police and the Haitian military, and they've kept them. And Haitian prosecutors and investigators who've wanted to probe the terrorist acts by these forces haven't been able to get the access they should. And Constant has, in essence, been given sanctuary in the United States.
We're talking to journalist and activist Alan Nairn, who exposed the relationship between FRAP, the paramilitary death squad, in Haiti during the coup of 91 to 94, the relationship between FRAP and the U.S. intelligence agencies. Also on the line with us is Congressmember Maxine Waters. On the issue of Emmanuel Toto Constant, who is right here in the United States, Congressmember Waters, is there any move in Congress in, you know, being a part of the war on terror to go after this person who is responsible for so many deaths and to call for his trial and imprisonment here in the United States?
Unfortunately, no. He's walking around up in New York. He's been cited by several people who have mentioned having seen him. And as your guest was saying, Alan Nairn, that he was on the CIA DIA payroll, and he's protected. I wouldn't even be surprised if he didn't end up back in Haiti, just as you have heard that Guy Philippe is back there and Chamblain is back there. These murderers and ex-FRAP members reentered without anybody saying a word. The United States knows where these guys are. They may still be on the CIA payroll, but certainly they would know what their movement is. They know that they're back. They know that they're armed, and they know what they're doing. It's a coup d'etat in motion all over again with the same players. And this time, not only do you have the same players, they appear to be working in cooperation with not only our government, but the so-called Opposition Committee of 184 that's led by Andy Appiah. And while Andy Appiah and so-called negotiators on behalf of the civil society, as they call themselves, are refusing to sit down at the table and work with the so-called International Committee and sign off on some kind of peace agreement, old FRAP members just keep moving. It's a game. That's orchestrated, all with Noriega at the helm. The opposition keeps refusing. FRAP keeps moving. The president is backed up against the corner. The international players, one by one, will come out and say, well, you have to resign. All they have to do is send a stabilizing force in there. It doesn't have to be huge numbers. If they were, if they wanted to protect a democratically elected president who only has 2 years to go in his term, the agreement that he signed basically said he would let them choose the prime minister, who has the responsibility over the cabinet and the police force. But that's not good enough. They want the whole thing right now. They want to get in control of government so they can control the elections.
And Congressman, yes. Congresswoman Waters, one of the things that's been raised a lot in the media here in this country is the issue of rigged elections in Haiti, that Aristide is really not exercising a legitimate power. There's an interesting piece in today's New York Times op-ed piece that really begins to unmask some of these allegations that in reality, yes, there were some contested senatorial seats in the last election that were criticized, but that Aristide agreed to have all of those seats, those senators resigned, had them resign, and was willing to hold new elections. What's your perspective of this issue of legitimacy or non-legitimacy of the Aristide government?
Well, you know, you hear allegations about Aristide, but nobody can put any facts to them. I ask, tell me, and I've researched, as people refer to the failed elections, and what I've found is I believe there were 8 Senate seats that were contested, and the question was whether or not there should be a runoff. Eventually, because there was so much confusion about it, Aristide did ask them to resign, and they did. Now, as I understand it, those elections took place before Aristide took office in his second election. That he was not involved in that election, but he gets blamed for it. That's my understanding of it. So it seems as if no matter what he does, it's not good enough. Now, I've asked people to confirm for me the allegations about drug trafficking, corruption, and failed elections, and still I don't have any facts, any information. Then people told me that, well, you know, he was involved with the gangs, and the gangs were out there beating up on people and attacking folks who were anti-Aristide. I've researched a story about a gang leader named Metier, who is supposedly, because of his death, is the source of the problem up in Ghanaive, where his brother is part of the thugs that had first took over Ghanaive. What I discovered in my investigation was there was this gang leader named Metier who worked for the president. And when this gang leader got out of hand and started to retaliate on people who were opposed to Aristide, Aristide had him put in jail, because that's not what he was doing. What Aristide was doing is what many of us do in these cities, and that is we try to change the lives of these people who are in gangs. We try to get them gainful employment. We try to get them in school. We try to get them in programs. Seems like that what he was doing. And when he got out of hand and started to misuse the association he had with the president and his government, he had him locked up. And then his brother and some others took a bulldozer and bulldozed the jail and broke him out. So, and after he was broken out of jail, he was murdered. And then the opposition started the story that he was murdered by Aristide and turned the brother and some of those people up in Ghanaive against the president. And they now are in some ways joined with the opposition in carrying out the dirty end of it.
Finally, as we wrap up, Alan Nairn, as you reflect back on the period of the coup of 1991-94 and look at what's happening today, your thoughts?
Well, it's what's happening now in a way is a tragedy that grew from crime. It's an unspeakable crime what's been done to Haiti. Long ago, it was a rich country. It was stripped of its wealth by France. The U.S. Has backed terror there over the years. Haitian people were living on the brink of survival. When you're that poor, your only chance for getting out of it is to be great. You can't behave like a mere mortal, or you'll fall. You'll die. And for a period, in the early, late 80s, the early 90s, Haitians really achieved political greatness. They put together a popular movement that brought down Baby Doc Duvalier. They thwarted U.S. designs in what they thought would be a fixed election, an election instead that brought Aristide to power with two-thirds of the vote. They tried to push a popular platform that would raise the minimum wage, redistribute wealth to the poor, but they were facing horrible pressures. Bush won, and then Clinton backing these criminal paramilitaries. Later, the U.S. Cutting off promised aid to Haiti, and they also faced the temptations of power. I mean, I think part of the fall for what's happening now does lie with Aristide. He accepted the World Bank IMF plan under U.S. pressure. He started to implement it. I think there is evidence that he has grown corrupt over the years. He did back gangs to fight his political opponents, often former Lavalas allies, and that's a tragedy. He started behaving like many politicians do, like a normal political boss. And the popular movement has come to a very low state. I mean, it's astonishing that these paramilitaries could come in to Hache and Gonaive and other places, and with just a few hundred armed men take these cities. In the old days, that could never have happened. The people would have risen up. They would have stopped it with their bare hands, with machetes. They would have torn these paramilitaries apart. But Aristide has evidently lost a great deal of popular support. The larger crime, though, that helped to create this was the way that a few miles from Miami Beach, you have one of the poorest countries in the world, a place that has been stripped of its wealth, where people live on less than $500 a year. That shouldn't be tolerated. There should be a massive transfer of wealth to Haiti from the rich countries that that benefited from the old wealth of Haiti, and the law should be enforced. Criminals like Jodel Chamblain should be prosecuted and jailed. So should the first President Bush, so should President Clinton for backing them over the years. And then maybe you can create a situation where Haitians don't have to be great to have a chance at survival, and they can make mistakes like everybody else and still lead a decent life.
Well, on that note, I want to thank you both very much for being with us. Alan Nairn, journalist and activist, won the George Polk Award for exposing the role of U.S. intelligence in the formation of the paramilitary death squads in Haiti during the first coup of 91 to 94, and Congress member Maxine Waters. After our break, we will look at transgender couples. The thousands of couples that are getting married now in San Francisco are not the first same-sex married couples in this country. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
They say everything can be replaced. They say every distance is not near. So I remember every face of every man who put me here. I see my life come shining from the west down to the
Nina Simone, I Shall Be Released. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
Well, it's become one of the most controversial acts of civil disobedience in recent times. San Francisco's mayor this month ordered city officials to issue marriage licenses to same-sex couples. Thousands flocked to City Hall to get married. Most people view this as the first time in U.S. history that same-sex couples could enjoy the same legal rights as a married man and a woman. But for some time now, hundreds of same-sex couples across the country have been living as married couples under the law. They are couples who married as man and woman, and later one spouse underwent a gender change.
Transsexual or transgender couples are the focus of an NBC Dateline special that is going to be airing tomorrow night. Dateline followed a number of transgender couples for 2 years to get a closer look at their lives and the transformation they underwent. This is an excerpt of the Dateline special that will be airing tomorrow night.
This is a true test of marriage.
Yes, it is.
Meet Melissa and Stephanie, Judy and Leanne, and Cindy and Miriam. All of them, like Joyce and Victoria, married when the husbands were still men. This couple later renewed their vows as two women.
I, Cindy, take thee, Miriam.
To be my wedded spouse.
To be my wedded spouse.
While politicians and the public debate whether to legalize gay marriages in a few states, marriages like these are legal in all 50 states. That's right. Couples are still considered married under the law, even after one spouse goes through a sex change.
Are you in love?
Crazy, man.
Oh, yes. Yes.
Madly.
Love may conquer all, but each of these wives have shared some of the same strains Joyce talks about.
It was kind of like, oh, my God, where are we going from here?
Melissa's first reaction to the news her husband was becoming a woman, dead silence.
It was a jaw drop. And I definitely was not ready for that.
I have to admit, it was pretty selfish. What does this mean to me?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Is that selfish? I mean, isn't part of the relationship about
yes.
you?
Yes. Yeah.
Did any of you question whether you would stay in the relationship?
Oh, yeah.
No.
My second reaction after she told me she wanted to transition was, that's it, I'm gone.
But she chose not to leave. Just like the others. Joyce tells the group about her uncertainty over the sex change, but gives it a positive spin.
We have a different adventure to go on, and don't know where we're going to yet.
And Joyce learns she and Victoria aren't the only ones having trouble defining their change relationship.
Leanne and Judy, are you a lesbian couple?
No.
No.
No, we're spouses.
I'm a lesbian.
You're a lesbian?
Yeah. I've always loved women. Not the case for her.
So you're not a lesbian couple?
No. We're married.
There are people who are going to be confused.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. We're not too clear on it either.
Two of the wives admit their husband's gender change had made them wonder if there might be something wrong with them.
Did it make you feel less of a woman?
I think it did at first, because it's like, wait a minute, how can you be this way? You know, how could you not want your penis? You know, I mean, I'm serious, because every man that I've ever been with or knew, that was the most important thing to them.
Joyce, though, believes a husband's sex change shouldn't affect a wife's self-image.
They feel compelled to change. Do you feel as though you've been forced to change in some ways as a result?
No, it's a choice. You have a choice to stay or not to stay. Mm-hmm. If you love that person, you make the choice that is right for you.
Still, when the conversation turns to sex, Joyce doesn't want to say much.
And what you do behind closed doors is your own private business. You're married.
It's clear she's not ready yet, if she will ever be, for the sexual experimentation the other couples have tried.
When you love someone, you know, you're going to be together and you're going to show each other that you love each other.
For all those people who are wondering, are you having sex? Are you, yes?
Well, at this moment,
sex,
no.
Yes.
An excerpt from the program airing tomorrow night on Dateline called Scenes from a Marriage. Today we're going to speak with one of those couples, Cindy and Miriam Hipsher Scott. They're a married couple from the Midwest, married as husband and wife. Then Roger became Cindy, and Miriam chose to stay in that marriage. They're founders of an internet support group for the spouses of partners of transsexuals. We're also joined by the correspondent on that piece, Don Fratangelo, who is an NBC Dateline correspondent and a psychologist and gender specialist based in Atlanta as well. But let's begin with the couple, with Cindy and Miriam. Let me ask how you, Cindy, decided to make this transition.
It was a life choice. There was just no other way around it. I was born with this. I realized from the age of 4 that something was wrong, even though I didn't have a vocabulary to express it. And I fought against it all my life. Tried to be Mr. Macho, do all kinds of manly things, and it just didn't work out. The fact that my brain was oriented towards being a female was always there and always interfering.
And when you decided to make the change, about how long has it been? And did you have children beforehand?
Oh yeah, I've got 2 children. They're both technically adults right now. One's 19, the other one's going to be 21 in about a week. And I'm sorry, the first part of the question again. How long have I been transitioned? About 5 years.
About 5 years. How did your children deal with it?
We took a very unique step. We sat down, we decided we were going to have a kind of a family dinner conversation, try and keep it casual. And Miriam actually is the one that told them about it. We figured it would be better for them to hear it from her so that they would be reassured that our relationship was safe. And we were correct. They took their acceptance cues from Miriam.
We're also joined by Don Fratangelo. You have been following the story of not only Miriam and Cindy, but a number of these couples over 2 years. Remarkable that you should be on a story for that long.
Right. I really do want to commend these couples for letting us and our cameras into their homes to follow some of the most intimate and difficult issues in their life. We actually spent about 1 year and 4 months with another couple you saw in that clip from our hour-long program, Joyce and Victoria. And Victoria transition from David from into Victoria. And we really focus on the wives in this hour-long program and why and how they choose to stay. Because as Cindy was saying, she knew from the age of 4 that she felt like a woman, like a girl, and felt compelled to change her gender. Well, these wives, when they choose to stay, in, for lack of a better word, are forced, if you will, to change their sexual identity if they want to remain intimate in this relationship. And that's not an easy thing to do. And actually, that is at the very heart of the survival of the marriage of Joyce and Victoria now, is intimacy. And we follow that from beginning to end. I mean, how can a wife become intimate with another woman who was once her husband. Although it's the same person, that person has changed dramatically.
Well, let's put that question to Miriam.
I'm sorry, what was the question again?
How you made that transition, that your husband became your wife.
Slowly. Cindy and I talked about this at great length before she even started the transition and decided to take it in baby steps. You know, it wasn't like she was Roger one day and then Cindy the next. It was a gradual process that took, I'd say, maybe a year to 2 years to complete. So I was introduced to Cindy in small doses.
And at this point, how do your children accept, Cindy's children, how do they accept the transition from their father to, do they consider you their father or their mother, Cindy?
I'm still dad. There have been occasions out in public where they have called me mom for convenience sake, you know, at doctor's office or something like that, but... generally in public, they refer to me as Cindy, and at home, I'm still Dad.
Or Dad.
Yeah, or Dad. It was kind of hard for my daughter to lose the masculine, strong masculine personality. But my son has just been nothing short of amazing, amazing. It's really made a tremendous difference in his life, in his temperament, his demeanor, his personal compassion, his ability to grow.
In this last minute, we want to bring in Dr. Virginia Earhart, the licensed psychologist and gender specialist in Atlanta. You've worked with a number of transsexual couples. How typical is Cindy and Miriam's transition? What do you find are the greatest obstacles that couples have in transitioning? And do most leave each other if one wants to change their gender?
Well, unfortunately, it's still unusual for couples to stay together. In the past couple of years, I've seen an increase in couples trying to continue the marriage, and those who come into therapy are much more likely to continue. That shows a great dedication on the wife's part, just to be willing to come in and make that effort. There are many, many obstacles, as you can imagine, this particularly the wife's initial reaction, because the wife may initially be in shock. She may have discovered that her husband is transgendered rather than having it disclosed to her, and she may experience disbelief and a sense of betrayal at the deception, perhaps revulsion, fear, shame, and then she may be very, very hurt and angry, scared and ashamed.
Well, we're going to leave it there, but tomorrow on Dateline, tomorrow night, very interesting hour following a number of transgender, transsexual couples through a 2-year period. I want to thank you all for being with us. That does it for today's program. If you'd like to get a copy, you can call 1-800-881-2359. Our website is democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.